disappear. Everything changes from moment to moment. So, what do? Let go and set yourself free. Become independent. It's all a matter of training the mind, and the essence of this training is change, transformation. We need to train our minds and change ourselves on the mental, verbal, and physical levels. But in the end, everything stands and falls with the mind. Therefore, mental progress should be our top priority. We may say, I have recited millions of mantras. Look at my progress. But can we really measure spiritual progress by counting? I meditate 5 hours every day. Sure, that's training all right, but does that necessarily mean that we've broken free and moved on? There's no guarantee. Genuine practice changes us from within, making our minds supple and flexible. Spending 20 years meditating in a mountain cave hardly qualifies as progress if our minds are still rigid and follow the same old rut. Perhaps it would have been better just to set aside a few hours a day for contemplating impermanence. In the end, taming the mind is our own responsibility. Nobody can do it for us, not even the Buddha. That's why the Buddha said, I show you the path to liberation, but whether you follow it is up to you. Love. The seeming and the real. The study of the Dharma is for the purpose of realizing reality, the true nature of all things. With that insight, all our negative emotions and obscurations disappear. But we also need to know what the world looks like from the perspective of others. In other words, we need to understand the world in all its endless complexity, while at the same time never forgetting the reality that is its nature. That's the kind of insight we must aim for. It's important that we understand both dimensions, reality as it appears to others, and reality as it actually is. Knowing how others perceive the world is very valuable. We can't simply write off what others experience as wrong and leave it at that. Seen from the awakened perspective, the way ordinary beings perceive the world is indeed mistaken, but to us, it's all very genuine. No matter how confused and deluded we may be, we instinctively feel that our experience is real. That's why Buddhism talks about the two aspects of reality, the seeming and the real. The seeming reality is certainly not irrelevant because it's intuitively taken to be real. The Buddha's path. On the other hand, if we take a closer look, we find that what otherwise seemed true and real is in fact neither. That discovery enables us to gain insight into the nature of things. We need to strike a delicate balance. We must acknowledge the way things appear, but at the same time remain open and ready to recognize the way things actually are. How do we make it work? First, we receive teachings and explanations, and we reflect deeply on what we hear. This way we arrive at a clear understanding of what the Dharma is actually about. The next step is to train in letting our newly acquired knowledge inform our lives. We need to apply our understanding in practical and concrete ways as we go through life. That is the only way to gain direct experience of the teachings. This is the Buddha's path to insight, openness, and realization. Scripture and realization. The type of instruction we receive and the kind of methods we employ will depend on who we are and how we work best. Dharma has two components, scripture, which refers to the teachings of the Buddha as they have been transmitted through the ages, and realization, which is the insight that unfolds through study and practice. First we listen, then we examine and reflect on what we heard, and finally we apply our understanding in practical contexts. For this process to succeed, we also need a foundation in ethics and a sense of discipline. Vows, ethics, and discipline. Ethical discipline entails a commitment to living life in the most constructive way possible. Buddhism provides different sets of vows that can assist us in this process. Buddhism's three major vehicles of teaching, the foundational vehicle, the great vehicle, and the Vajra vehicle, each have their own specific vows, and there is a huge body of literature on the distinctions among these vehicles and the details of their vows. Nevertheless, the three categories of vows can, fortunately, also be described in more general terms. If we can avoid causing other beings any kind of pain or distress, then we're keeping the vows of the foundational vehicle, which are focused on achieving freedom for ourselves. Next, if we not only avoid hurting others, but also work for their benefit and happiness, then we are keeping the vows of the great vehicle, which is committed to bringing all beings to the awakened state. Finally, if we additionally acknowledge the fundamental purity of all things, and if we are capable of living in accord with that realization, then we are keeping the vows of the Vajra vehicle that bring complete awakening in this very life. Whether we receive teachings, reflect on what we have heard, or apply our understanding in practical contexts, it is important that we do so while following those three aspects of ethical commitment. Many approaches. The instructions and explanations we receive are always adjusted to suit our individual disposition and capacity for understanding. Each of us has our own individual perspective on the world, and all such individual perceptions and beliefs matter. Although mistaken with respect to the way things actually are, we still need to take our experience of the world into consideration. That's why there are many different Buddhist philosophical traditions. They address people's distinct interests, beliefs, and abilities. A commitment to truth. People often ask me if Buddhism is a religion or a philosophy. Buddhism may look like a religion or a philosophy, but in fact it is neither. Buddhism is a commitment to truth. The purpose of Buddhism is to understand and experience things as they really are. When we dedicate ourselves to this, we become Buddhists. Buddhism is not a religious or a philosophical project. Some people call Buddhism a religion because as Buddhists we seek refuge in the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. But in the end, the only reason we seek refuge is that we seek the realization of the way things actually are. That's why we rely on the Buddha, the source of wisdom, the Dharma, the teachings of awakening, and the Sangha, the community of people committed to the realization we are seeking. Step by step. The three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, are actually our only real support. It doesn't matter how healthy, fit, successful, wealthy, intelligent, respected, or renowned we may be, one day we'll all suddenly be gone and everything will be different. We know this quite well already, but we prefer not to think about it. Still, what will we do when one day the rug is pulled from under our feet? Sure, we can pray to gods and guardian angels, but as the Buddha advises, we shouldn't have unrealistic expectations. There is a limit to the amount of help we can receive, even from an awakened Buddha. The Buddha promised to show us how we can free ourselves from ignorance, delusion, destructive emotions, and suffering. His instructions are easy to understand and to apply, and the effects are concrete. But we also have to do our part of the job. The Buddha can show us how, but he can't do it all for us. The Buddha shows us the path, but we need to move forward step by step. That's just the way it is. Religion and science. These days, religion is a sensitive issue. In the past, religion used to play a significant role in people's daily lives, but nowadays the picture is more mixed. Some people think that religion is plain evil. Others think that it's a relic of the past, irrelevant in the contemporary world. There are also those who think that religion holds people in such a powerful grip that it's better just to play along and pretend to be a believer. Other people take their religion very, very seriously, thinking that their particular beliefs are the only true faith. Such people usually have little knowledge of other religions, yet they insist that everybody must believe what they themselves believe. A central theme in many religions is the belief in an almighty and omniscient power that we cannot meet face to face, a sort of transcendent principle or being that sees everything we do, knows everything about us, and is capable of the most amazing feats. We, on the other hand, remain unable to hear or see this all-powerful entity. Through the ages, variations on this idea have become foundational in many religions, but the rise of science has increasingly challenged such convictions. It's not easy for a scientifically minded person to believe in an omnipresent God or divine power whose existence defies logic and cannot be verified through our senses. Science has produced remarkable and life-changing discoveries and inventions that have made life easier and more comfortable. Even something like traveling from one place to another is altogether different and much less time-consuming than in the past. Science has no gods, yet it has granted us so many boons that it is hard for us not to place our trust in science. Even if we try to avoid trusting science, the marvelous effects of scientific thinking are still right in our face. Of course, science is also responsible for many unfortunate things. Just think about all the deadly weapons that were once inconceivable, but are now part of our world. Still, many people believe more in science than religion. From a Buddhist perspective, that's actually okay. As Buddhists, aren't we always encouraged to investigate things carefully and objectively, just as scientists attempt to do? Buddhism has no dogma. We need to investigate things carefully and objectively. And that also goes for the Dharma. We shouldn't think that Buddhism is the absolute truth and that doubting it would be a sin. On the contrary, our task is to be critical. The Buddha said, "Monks, when you listen to my words, you must examine them carefully, like a skilled goldsmith who tests gold by heating, cutting, and rubbing. Do not accept my words merely out of respect." The Buddha tells us that we shouldn't accept his words just because they are his. This sets Buddhism apart from many other religions. Some religions consider it a sin to question anything at all that is taught in their holy scriptures. Other religions may encourage their followers to investigate things a bit more closely, but only up to a point. And if we happen to cross the line, we'll soon find out. However, in Buddhism, there is no limit to what we may question. There are no dogmas that must remain unchallenged. This is a special feature of the Buddhist teaching and the Buddhist path. Practicing the Dharma is a hands-on, concrete activity that begins by observing the world and ourselves. Impermanence. For example, we will notice that no matter what we may build, it's just a matter of time before it falls apart. We all know the urge to create something, and we may work really hard to make our wishes come true. Yet no matter how skilled or hardworking we are, whatever we may succeed in building or assembling will sooner or later disappear. That's just the way it is, and there's nothing we can do about it. When we meet, it's just a matter of time before we will part ways again. No two people can stay together forever. Our money in the bank will also be gone one day. This is the nature of conditioned existence. Cradle to grave. Deep down, we know it very well. Birth ends in death, and that goes for every one of us. Whoever enters this world is doomed to leave it again. We're all in different phases of our lives. Some of us are young, some are middle-aged, some are old, some are in what could poetically be called life's sunset. Yet none of us knows how many years we have left. Death can come to anyone at any time, that is certain. But we have absolutely no idea when it will come. The only thing we know for a fact is that at some point we will die. Action. Many of the things we keep in mind as Buddhists are actually quite banal. But they are nevertheless very helpful because they give us the sense that we'd better make something of our lives while we still have the chance. Otherwise, while we wait, time quietly runs out. Life is over before we know it. But the thought of impermanence urges us to seize the moment, discover what's going on, and what Buddhism is really about. Not just as dry intellectual knowledge, but also in a way that really makes a difference in our lives. We need an insight that causes us to break free from all the misguided thoughts and ideas that otherwise distort our perception of things. We need a breakthrough that allows us to let go of all the emotions that keep pushing us from one miserable situation to another. Freedom. A breakthrough is exactly what the Buddha's teachings are here to deliver. The Buddha demonstrated true freedom and the way to experience it. Genuine freedom is absolute freedom, a freedom from emotions, a freedom that doesn't belong to anyone, a freedom that we can share with all beings. The Buddha showed us a path that ultimately transforms an ordinary person into an awakened Buddha, someone who has conquered all there is to conquer, has accomplished all there is to accomplish, and is capable of communicating this wisdom to others. Change, pain, and progress. Everything we experience is in a process of change. Each and everything we see, hear, smell, taste, or touch is changing from one moment to the next. That also goes for all that we have achieved in this life. Wealth, enjoyment, status. They may be ours for a while, but then they evaporate. There's nothing in this world that we can actually rely on. Deep down, we know that perfectly well. We do know that conditioned things are impermanent. Everything that exists due to causes is bound to disappear, but it's scary to think about it. All that we love and cherish will be gone. What a painful, sad recognition. Yet, it's a necessary one. Not because we want to sit with melancholic tears in our eyes, but because this acknowledgement calls us to action. It inspires us towards awakening. The remedy. Whether we like it or not, all things that exist because of other things are impermanent. We need to take this into account because that's how it is. As Dharma practitioners, we have a remedy. We can break the mind's conditioning that otherwise holds us to a perception of things that is neither constructive nor enjoyable for anyone. We can do away with the ignorance that produces the experience of a painful world. It's a real option. As practitioners, we acknowledge the facts and act upon them. That's what an ordinary person fails to do. Spiritual training. Sooner or later, we all have to face change and impermanence. There will come a day when the world reveals its impermanent nature, and then we encounter the painful, sad facts firsthand. That type of experience hits ordinary people very hard. It's also hard for practitioners, but there's a big difference. Practitioners know what to do in the situation. They aren't left with only a painful recognition. They have a remedy, and the remedy is spiritual training. Having a choice. There are many ways to train. For example, we can just work on developing an attitude toward our surroundings that is less rigid and more open and accommodating. That's one simple, effective remedy. It's important to understand that the basic facts remain the same, whether or not we are practitioners. But Dharma practitioners have a choice. They don't have to merely register the painful facts. They can actually do something about them. Heart of stone. How do you feel when you realize that everything around you will disappear? That nothing lasts? Doesn't it make you sad? If you think, oh, well, what to do? That's the way the world is. Then you haven't really thought through what this truly means. If you think deeply about impermanence, it is impossible not to be struck by a deep sorrow. If things were different, if things actually lasted, then it would be ridiculous to sit around and think that everything's going to disappear. But we just need to open our eyes and look around to see that that is not the case. We won't be in doubt. Everything we see, hear, and experience changes character from moment to moment. So-and-so is now ill. So-and-so has now died. Such-and-such is withering. Such-and-such is fading. Such-and-such is no more. It hurts to notice all this, no matter who we are. If we allow ourselves to reflect on the impermanence of everyone and everything, a profound sense of sorrow sets in. It would take a heart of stone to remain unaffected. Depression. News comes to us about people falling ill and dying. We learn that suddenly people can't seem to get along. We find that things have been destroyed, broken, and torn apart. In such cases, the underlying reason is always impermanence. And impermanence hurts, But we need to recognize life for what it is. That's the only way we can develop an approach to life that is realistic as well as constructive. In fact, if all the pain and sorrow seem paralyzing, we haven't quite gotten it yet. Getting stuck is getting it wrong. Getting stuck means getting depressed, and becoming depressed just makes a tough situation worse. So we need an approach that recognizes the fact of impermanence, but uses it as an opportunity to develop the qualities of love and insight. Courage. For that to happen, we first need courage to face pain and sorrow openly and honestly. Everything changes, including ourselves, those around us, and all that we own. The people we have known, loved, and lived with will not remain with us. The things we value and consider ours, even our standing and status in society, none of it will remain. Things change, but nobody can say exactly when or how. Those are the basic facts of life. Change just comes to us, and there's nothing we can do to halt it. Therefore, we need to see the world as it is, and we must know how to relate constructively to pain and impermanence. Suffering. In Buddhism, we hear a lot about suffering, but people often misunderstand what that really means. Suffering isn't just about sickness, starvation, and poverty. Of course, those are aspects of suffering, but suffering in the Buddhist sense goes much deeper. In the Buddhist understanding, we're always confronted with suffering, no matter how much or little we own or how sick or healthy we are. Suffering means to be controlled by hope and fear, over and over, again and again. That is suffering. In a moment of clarity, we realize that we have no clue what might happen just 5 minutes from now. Everything is uncertain and doubtful. We have no idea what life may have in store for us. All for nothing. There is only one cure for suffering, and that is practice. Wealth and fame won't solve this problem. Intelligence, power, and influence can't help us either. Human history abounds with kings and emperors and presidents, heads of state, who ruled over vast realms, yet were ultimately forced to surrender to impermanence. Take a moment to think how they must have felt. Some even took their own lives. They conquered, ruled, and decreed. But in the end, what did they get out of it? They couldn't keep anything at all. We are powerless against impermanence, family, friends, merit, and intelligence. Nothing can protect us. Whether we are doctors, scientists, politicians, or business people, all of us must capitulate when facing impermanence. The only real source of help is our attitude, which can be developed through meditation practice. Panic. As soon as we begin thinking about impermanence, panic creeps in and we think, one day I will be separated from all my loved ones. No matter what I build or gather, I can't keep any of it. Nothing lasts. I can't trust anything. It really is terribly sad, and thinking about it hurts. We'd rather not consider or talk about impermanence. We prefer to forget all about it as soon as possible. We certainly don't want to look at death, deal with death, or talk about death. When something is unpleasant and painful, we want it to disappear instantly. Nobody wants to hold on to a source of pain. On the other hand, whenever we find something that is enjoyable and gives us pleasure, we want to keep it as long as possible, preferably forever. We pick flowers and arrange them in a vase, but when they are no longer fresh and beautiful, we throw them away because their ugliness turns us off. We wish only to enjoy their beauty and lovely scent. But ugliness doesn't suddenly descend onto the flowers. Ugliness, decay, and the smell of rot are just as intrinsic to the flowers as their beauty. All are equally the results of impermanence. Sadness, our friend. If we don't practice meditation, impermanence will be our worst enemy. But if we do, that same impermanence becomes our best friend. As we develop our understanding of impermanence, we discover calm. With balance and calm, there naturally comes a greater capacity for love and care. We can afford to be caring. And as we become increasingly kind-hearted and responsive to others, our minds brighten. Insight into the way things really are grows from loving care. Love nurtures wisdom. Understanding impermanence is the basis for all that is good, wholesome, joyful, and great. In that way, impermanence is our greatest teacher and our foremost source of inspiration. Coming to terms with impermanence involves sorrow and pain, but if that sadness becomes deeply integrated in our lives, we will definitely become exemplary practitioners. That's guaranteed. On the other hand, if the sadness is with us only sometimes and to a limited extent, then we are only half-hearted practitioners. Moreover, if this feeling is weak and rarely present in our minds, then we resemble practitioners only occasionally, but most of the time, not at all. If we ignore the impermanence of things, it's easy to lose all connection with the Dharma. It becomes simply uninteresting. In fact, ignoring impermanence is a characteristic of people who do not practice. Dharma practitioners, on the other hand, continuously remind themselves about the impermanence of all things and appreciate it because they know how important that awareness is. Please don't underestimate the significance of understanding impermanence. It's a crucial subject. Perseverance. To practitioners, impermanence is a kind friend, but to ordinary people, it's their archenemy, someone who keeps hurting them. That's why it's so important to be aware of impermanence, to bring it to mind and take it to heart. We need to consider impermanence as our guru, our teacher. As soon as we forget about impermanence, we lose our focus and become distracted by a lot of things that make us lose sight of what is truly important. Our practice becomes half-hearted. We put it off. When I was a young student, my teachers would often speak to us about impermanence. It made me feel uneasy and sad, and I found the topic both boring and irritating. Often, I just didn't want to hear about it at all. Today, I realize how those teachings have helped me. Faith. Faith is quite a sensitive issue. Most people find the idea of compassion compelling. But faith? Why would we want faith? But as Buddhists, we tell each other to have faith in the three jewels. Faith begins with trust, because there's something we have to become clear about. In Buddhism, we need to become clear about dependent origination. That clarity automatically leads to faith. Once we have really understood dependent origination, we cannot help feeling faith. It wells up inside us, whether we like it or not. Dependent origination is a crucial issue. People who are not religious often regard religious beliefs and convictions as mere superstitions, and they feel a kind of pity for those who subscribe to them. Meanwhile, religious people pity non-believers, thinking of them as lost souls. So everyone pities each other, back and forth. Faith, in a Buddhist context, lies between these two positions. Buddhist faith arises through understanding, and what we need to understand is dependent origination and impermanence. It can be very simply put. Buddhist faith arises as one becomes clear about the links that constitute these processes. From impermanence to compassionate wisdom. We have talked about impermanence and how painful it is to acknowledge that everything, including ourselves and all that we love, is going to perish. But the recognition of impermanence is also the threshold to something more, something greater. The reason we take impermanence to heart is that we need that understanding to inspire and guide us. Impermanence closes the gap between others and ourselves. When we recognize that everyone is subject to the same merciless conditions, we cannot but respond with affection. With the recognition of the impermanent world comes great compassion, genuine care. This pivotal discovery provides the circumstances for a complete opening of our minds. As compassion gains force, it enables our minds to recognize the profound nature of emptiness, the true nature of things that lies beyond all concepts. Sorrow and pain become catalysts for deep-felt loving care, and the power of universal compassion delivers the realization of the true view. That's when we have truly become students of the Dharma. Love and compassion for all. Understanding impermanence makes it possible for us to regard all beings with love and compassion. Genuine love and compassion are not intended only for certain individuals, groups, or categories of beings. Genuine love and compassion embrace everyone. True love and compassion are all-encompassing, unconditional, and sincere. The more love and compassion we have within us, the more natural it will be to realize the true nature of things. The liberating insight into the way things really are begins to unfold from within. When the realization of impermanence has set us free, so that there is a welling up inside us of love and compassion for all beings, true insight will expand and grow by itself. Natural presence. What is true insight? What is the view that recognizes reality, the true nature of all things? And what is our own true nature? Actually, we all possess the awakened state within us as a natural endowment. So when we refer to the Buddha as the awakened one, we're actually talking about something that we ourselves have always possessed. The awakened qualities and wisdom are naturally and spontaneously present within us, and that presence can be recognized through the right view. The very essence of awakening is not something extrinsic to us. We possess it already and can never lose it, even if we wanted to. The awakened state is present in all beings, whether they appreciate it or not. That is the right view, true insight. But if we want genuine insight to unfold, we will need universal love and compassion. These two qualities arise naturally and spontaneously when we take impermanence to heart. When in that way we arrive at the genuine view, we become capable of communicating this liberating realization to others, skillfully and compassionately. At that point, we finally become a loving servant, savior, and friend to all beings. All that is required for this to happen is that we set the process in motion. How do we help others? When we talk about love and compassion, it's important that we understand what's behind the words. In Buddhism, the objects of our love and compassion are all beings, and all really means all. But how do we help all beings? We must begin by examining what we can actually do for others. Let's ask ourselves what we can do to remove their pain, be it physical or mental, and how we can give them joy and well-being, both in the present and also from a long-term perspective. If we want to practice love and compassion toward all beings, we need to understand that the best way to help is through developing wisdom. The mind of awakening. One way we can be of help to others is actually just a matter of thinking like this. I want to help all beings. I want to liberate them from all types of suffering and give them all that is good and meaningful. This intention, called the mind of awakening, known in Sanskrit, is bodhicitta, possesses tremendous power. When we begin to think in this way, when we sincerely wish to help and protect all beings, then all our negative thoughts and emotions automatically disappear. They simply cannot coexist with the mind of awakening. With a mind of awakening, it becomes impossible to be selfish. We cannot be envious, and there is no way that we would want to deceive or compete with anyone. The basis for malice and resentment is gone. This change is natural and undeniable. Once our coarse negative thoughts and emotions disappear, we will automatically be of use and benefit to others. Two thoughts. There is infinitely much that we might possibly think and feel. Myriads of different thoughts and ideas run through our minds. But among all the thoughts that we might possibly have, there are two that stand out as truly special. The first is the thought of impermanence. Thinking about impermanence clears the mind of its clutter. It enables us to think of and perceive the world in a way that is radically different and genuinely constructive. The second is love and compassion. Love and compassion hold inconceivable power. Love and compassion never lead us astray. Love and compassion strip the mind of negative emotions and unwholesome thoughts. Dharma practice is about recognizing impermanence so that love and compassion become all-encompassing and universal. The direct path. All-encompassing love and compassion are incredibly powerful. The goodness they bring is tremendous, simply unimaginable. That's why the mind of awakening, the sincere wish to help others, is considered such an important factor for the path. It heals and restores. When we are loving and compassionate, none of our selfish tendencies or negative emotions can find any bearing. Our consciousness is purified, and we can begin to think constructively. The mind of awakening allows us to care for others, giving them genuine joy and happiness, as well as true protection from suffering. But let's remember that all these wonderful qualities emerge only if we devote our love and compassion to all beings. Our love and compassion cannot be limited to our friends, family, and the people we already care about. We must extend our love and compassion to everyone, including strangers, and even those who seek to harm us. If we can do that, there's no better way to go through life. The mind of awakening has infinite wonderful qualities, and it leads us directly to freedom and true awakening. Intelligent love and compassion. Love and compassion must be paired with insight. Without intelligence, it's hard to be of real benefit to others. Obviously, we can help others in a limited manner, but we cannot accomplish anything that has truly far-reaching positive consequences. That's possible only when loving kindness and insight combine and mutually enrich each other. Love and compassion should arise and unfold based on insight and understanding, just as wisdom should be nourished and fueled by loving care. When that happens, our practice really takes off. Boundless love and compassion. Boundless love and compassion are unlimited and all-embracing. They extend to all beings. How are we to understand all? Again, all really means all. Could there be a love and compassion more true and real than that? A loving compassion that embraces every single being. That's the kind of love and compassion we must cultivate. When we feel equal love and compassion for everyone, near or far, whoever they are, then our practice is authentic. But that doesn't happen by itself. As beginners, we need to cultivate such a frame of mind, and we must stay alert to make sure it doesn't disappear. Healthy minds. The more trained we become, the less effort we need. As long as we actively cultivate love and compassion, as long as it's a conscious, deliberate activity, for that long, our practice will require a certain measure of effort. Nonetheless, even as we train in that way, we remain in a state that is thoroughly good and wholesome. When our love and compassion are warm and strong, no matter whom we encounter, the very basis for harming others disappears. Any inclination to hurt others is gone. Then everything we do springs from a wish to help and support others. Our only wish is to make them happy, now and forever. There's no evil, no negativity. Here we can really talk about a healthy mind, a consciousness that abounds with positive qualities and lets insight unfold naturally. Spontaneous love and compassion. When there is no negativity, animosity, or selfishness in our minds, realization unfolds by itself. We reach a point where insight into the true nature of things occurs naturally without any effort on our part. Then, once we see things as they really are and become aware of their actual nature, we begin to experience love and compassion at a level that is absolutely unparalleled. All-embracing love and compassion arise freely and without effort. That's what the teachings describe so beautifully. But at this point, it's actually happening all by itself. We don't need to do anything. universal love and compassion just well up in us. When Buddhism talks about great love and compassion, that's what is meant. This is what we are training to achieve. That one thing. Generally, we're not intimidated by hard work, whether it's physical or mental. That's because we want so much to be happy. This is true of all beings. No matter who we are or how we live our lives, everyone wants to improve on their current situation. Obviously, this is particularly true for people who don't know about Dharma. But let's be honest, we're all that way, aren't we? As soon as we get the sense that something can make us happy, we begin to work toward it with discipline and perseverance. The road may be long and full of trials, but we just toughen up and soldier on. We insist on finding happiness, no matter the cost. Some people have a clear idea about what it takes for them to be happy. It may be a certain job or title, or it might be fame, recognition, or simply to be known by a lot of people. For others, it might be privilege and luxury. Whatever it is we wish for ourselves, we get the feeling that only that and nothing else is what will satisfy us. Sad irony. The irony is rather tragic because our quest for happiness rarely brings us anything but suffering and negativity. As we strive to reach our goals, other people are reduced to extras on our stage, if not outright obstacles to be eliminated. We do things that we didn't think we would ever consider. The end justifies the means, as they say. That's how the world operates, and sometimes, much to our delight, we do succeed in getting our hands on the things we wanted. The problem, however, is that the happiness we feel then tends to be very short-lived. We have sweated and toiled, yet somehow we have a sneaking feeling that now the real work is only beginning, just when we thought it was time to lean back and enjoy the fruits of our labor. That is because nothing can be trusted. Impermanence is tough. Maintaining something requires at least as much effort as acquiring it in the first place. This is not merely unsatisfying, it's actually tragic. Obtaining something we have striven for is painfully meaningless unless we're able to enjoy it once we finally have it. Instead, we feel we have to be on guard all the time just to prevent it from disappearing. Another thing that makes life miserable is our instinctive tendency to conjure up new wishes and needs. As soon as we have achieved one thing, we immediately start thinking about something else that we can't live without. That way, we never manage to appreciate and enjoy what is here right now. That's how life is, at least for people who have no clue about Dharma practice. A different path. Dharma practitioners also look for happiness, but at the same time, they remain disciplined and determined. The search for happiness is therefore different. Dharma practitioners look for the very source of joy and happiness, and that source is found within us. Joy and happiness depend on three inner qualities: the wish to be free, loving kindness, and insight. When these three factors are present in our minds, joy and happiness will always naturally follow. When the wish to be free, loving kindness, and insight become our inner compass, our journey will surely be a happy one. Since Dharma practitioners search for a different kind of happiness, they also follow a different path. The Dharma doesn't lead us from one miserable situation to the next. The path of Dharma goes from joy to happiness, and not just personal, private happiness. The joy that is inspired by the Dharma is for the good of all beings. When we rely on love and insight, we ensure that our presence in this world benefits others. A warm and benevolent heart motivates all that we do. We wish that everyone may recognize and experience the qualities that are the source of true happiness and freedom from suffering, now and forever. When love and compassion become genuinely universal, they prevent us from acting in ways that harm anyone, including ourselves. Anger, selfishness, pride, and envy vanish like dewdrops in the morning sun. Genuine loving care benefits everyone. When loving kindness resides in our hearts, we will always make the right choices and move in the right direction, no matter what is our situation. Loving care for everyone is a source of happiness, now and in the future. The qualities of compassion. Great compassion speaks the truth and is never hypocritical. Great compassion does not hurt or deceive. Great compassion cares lovingly for others without any negative emotions or hidden agendas. Great compassion never leads us astray. When it wells up in us, we simply lose the capacity for malice, and everything we do is aimed at helping, healing, and comforting. Love and compassion are the source of true awakening. Genuine love and care for others are the qualities that purify all obscurations, dispel all obstacles, and dissolve all negative emotions. Love and compassion solve all problems and unlock all difficult situations. In short, love and compassion are the source of all that is good. Prerequisites. For our training to become genuine and effective, we need the wish for liberation. This enables us to break free from the cycle of life and death, and it builds a foundation for developing true love. As our love and compassion become constant, genuine, and pure, the awakened state will dawn like the rising sun. Without love and compassion, all our efforts would ultimately be in vain. Stains on the mirror. Without love and compassion, the mind is impure. Right now, our minds are like a mirror covered with smudges and streaks. When we look into the mirror, the image is blurred. But if we clean the mirror, it's easy to see that the mirror itself was never unclean. The same is true of our minds. The actual nature of the mind is pure and clear. That goes for everyone, from the tiniest insect to an awakened Buddha. The true nature of the mind is pure and clear. But unlike the mind of an awakened Buddha, our pure and clean minds are continuously stained by negative emotions. To remove those stains, we need love and compassion. Living practice. Earlier I mentioned how sorrow and weariness can help us to let go and break free from the cycle of life and death. That type of sadness is necessary, as it enriches us and widens our outlook. Such healthy sadness grows from contemplating the impermanent nature of everything around us. I've also mentioned the importance of giving rise to love and compassion. Reflecting on love and compassion is worthwhile because they should be our basic motivation in all that we do. It's not just when we sit on our meditation cushion that we need love and compassion. We need to be loving and compassionate when we're eating our meals, sitting on the toilet, having a good time, working, talking on the phone, and relaxing. In short, we need to remember our practice always, no matter where we are. Remember your practice at all times, from when you wake up until you go to bed, in fact, even while you sleep. That way, your body will become the retreat cabin in which your mind can practice. For that to happen, we need to watch the mind, because it's always up to new tricks. We constantly get distracted by work, entertainment, computers, and messages. Then we develop stress and attend seminars on mindfulness. But what does it really mean to be mindful? To be mindful is to remind oneself. And what did the Buddha ask us to remember? Love and insight. Mindfulness, alertness, and carefulness. To remember love and insight, we need three tools: mindfulness, alertness, and carefulness. In Buddhism, we make use of these three methods, but it's important to remember that they aren't ends in themselves. They're just tools. Mindfulness means keeping in mind how to practice. Alertness means being aware of everything that goes on around us. Carefulness is being judicious about all that we do physically, verbally, and mentally. We depend on mindfulness, alertness, and carefulness to become clear about impermanence, to let our love and compassion grow, and to make our insight authentic. The wish to be free, loving kindness, and insight, that's what it's all about. These are the very essence of the Buddha's teachings. Mindfulness, alertness, and carefulness are the means whereby we awaken and strengthen those vital qualities. What happens when we make use of mindfulness, alertness, and carefulness? We become less confused, more relaxed, more grounded. Our negative emotions arise less frequently, and we become more loving, compassionate, and bright. Buddhist therapy? Buddhist practice works incredibly well. The Dharma has tremendous power as long as we get off on the right foot and follow through. So it's not that helpful to single out any one technique, remove it from its traditional context, and then make a big deal about it. If we do that, it's very easy to miss the actual point. Unfortunately, this happens quite a lot these days. People stumble upon a Buddhist technique and advertise it as some particular therapy. The real significance and context of the practice is deliberately toned down, and instead it is presented as a groundbreaking scientific discovery. People love that kind of thing, and with a bit of luck, it's also possible to get rich and famous that way. But the fact is that the unique methods of Buddhism are presented to the general public out of context and without proper training. That's not a service to anyone. The Dark Age. The Buddha spoke of a future dark age when the elements of nature become imbalanced and cause great harm. New diseases will appear, new types of weapons will be invented, and so on. The Buddha also described the dark age as a time when all that is natural and authentic loses importance, and instead people worship what is artificial and false. This applies to people as well as to things. We now live in a time when people with good and healthy qualities, who have meaningful things to say, rarely get much attention. At the same time, people who have nothing much to offer speak to sold-out crowds. People aren't interested in the real thing, but if we can come up with something that seems like the real deal, then it becomes popular right away. The same goes for the food we eat. People rarely appreciate genuine, natural ingredients. We prefer products that are processed, artificial, and most important, cheap. Everywhere we are surrounded by products that are artificial and cheap, while the genuine, uncontaminated, and authentic is becoming rare. We live in the 21st century, and we like to think of ourselves as modern, sophisticated, and civilized. But honestly, what kind of civilization pays tribute to things that are fake, cheap, and contaminated? A civilized world? We live in a time when technology increasingly controls our lives. We have invested technology with so much power that we can no longer survive without all its comforts. We started this process ourselves, and now we struggle to keep up. Day by day, we become increasingly insignificant. Compared with the force of the all-powerful weapons that exist today, we are nothing, even less than ants. And yet those weapons were not made by demons or aliens from another planet. They were made by humans, just like me and you. The weapons are here to protect us, we might say, but that's a false confidence. If we ever press the red button, others will do the same. If we bomb them, bombs will rain on us. That's cause and effect, and it will just go on and on. So what can we do? Only one thing can help us: loving kindness. Loving kindness is the very foundation of a civilized world. Openness. Selflessness. I would like to stress once again how crucial it is to have the right motivation in the context of Dharma practice. Whether we are listening, reading, practicing, translating, or simply helping out, whatever we do in relation to the Dharma should always be done with a sincere wish to help and protect others. Don't hope for respect and admiration. Don't think of accumulating merit. In short, don't expect a reward. It might sound strange, but the less we care about recognition from others, the more recognized we will be, and our rewards will be that much greater. The nature of mind. Among people interested in Buddhism these days, there is an increasing desire to receive instructions that point out the nature of the mind. People may have read about such an introduction in books or on the internet. In any case, there's a lot of talk about pointing out or introduction, but often people don't really know what that means. When people visit me in my monastery in Nepal, they sometimes ask, "Please introduce me to the nature of my mind." My plane leaves tomorrow morning, so I'm in a bit of a hurry. It almost sounds as if they think the nature of mind is a special thing, a bit like a tourist attraction, which they have to see before they're off to the airport. On other occasions, people talk to me as if I were a gardener and the nature of mind were a rare flower that they want to see and smell. The Buddha's teachings are one continuous introduction to the way things really are. So far, we have been introduced to impermanence and suffering. Nothing is reliable. Nothing lasts. Everything is fragile. Everything changes. The reason we spend so much time talking about impermanence and suffering is that our approach to life needs to change. This change happens naturally when we feel that we have encountered the truth. And it is true that there is nothing to rely on. The truth is that everything changes from moment to moment. Fame, wealth, power, privilege, as well as our health and friendships, the tides turn, the winds of fortune shift. Everything changes, always. Whenever we take a moment to pause, we realize that we already know this fact of life. That's a sign that the introduction to impermanence has hit home. Now we know. That is a powerful and crucial recognition. So, let's not spend our lives fantasizing about a magic moment when our teacher introduces us to the nature of mind and we live happily ever after. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that the introduction to the nature of mind isn't important. It most certainly is important. In fact, it's crucial. But because it's so important, we should ask ourselves if we have truly understood the significance of impermanence and suffering. Do we actually get this profound message? And do we take its implications to heart? If not, then we're not going to benefit from teachings on the nature of mind, because we're simply not ready. Humility. Now that we have received the introduction to impermanence, we need to practice accordingly. So how do we incorporate impermanence in our practice? We keep in mind that there's nothing for us to rely on. This humbles us and grounds us. I know this from personal experience. When I was a young child living in Tibet with my family, the monks at my monastery treated me as if I were a Buddha. My mother used to warn me, "Be careful, you have not yet fully awakened. Unless you practice, you could end up in trouble." Of course, I respected my mother's advice, but it was only when I was forced to flee from violence and invasion that I became truly grounded. Overnight, my family lost everything and became beggars. We had no passports, nowhere to go. That experience really grounded me. It made me a better practitioner, and today, I'm very grateful to the communists for introducing me to impermanence. In other words, please don't think that your current circumstances won't ever change, because they will. Wealth dries up. We may be young and healthy, but sooner or later, a serious disease will strike us. That is, if we are lucky enough even to live that long. Death can come at any time. Nothing is certain. Everything changes all the time. Of course, impermanence also sometimes means change is for the better. Poverty can change to affluence, and diseases may be cured, but only for a while, because everything is temporary and nothing lasts. Right now, we have a unique opportunity to let ourselves become intimately familiar with impermanence, because now we know. Trivialities. We like to think that our existence somehow has a very profound purpose, but actually it's quite trivial. We are born, grow up, go to school, graduate, get a job, and make money. Maybe we marry, maybe we don't. Maybe we have kids, maybe we don't. But the basic routine is the same for all of us. We talk about the weather and attend important meetings. We make plans for the future and purchase the things we want, and so life passes. But if we suffuse our life with a spiritual outlook, we can go beyond its trivialities and give it a deeper meaning. Distractions. The more sophisticated we become, the less time we seem to have. Progress rarely allows us to relax. The more developed and civilized we are, the harder it is for us to live in a natural way. We become blind to the world around us. Trees, leaves, birds, and flowers, We hardly notice them. We rush around and rarely are truly present, even in the company of our friends and family. We're always occupied by something. And in those rare moments when we're able to slow down, the small portable